Attention. This podcast contains subject matter that may not be suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised. From out of the darkness, you hear voices that send shivers down your spine. That feeling of dread is undeniable. When you notice the monster under the bed is trembling. The aliens are scrambling to get back to the mothership, and the vampires are refusing to rise. Your reptilian overlords are pleased to force on you two humans they swear are not their captives. Your hosts, Michael and Wendy. This is Eerie and Absurd.
Welcome back to Eerie and Absurd. I'm Mike.
I'm Wendy.
And this is our part two
of the Leicester Street Massacre.
Yeah.
Where we left off.
A little quick recap.
Was Memphis, 2008. Jesse Dotson just got arrested for the murders of Cecil Dotson, his 30-year-old brother, Marissa Williams, 27 years old, who is his brother's fiance, 33-year-old Hollis Seals, friend of the family, 22-year-old Shendry Robertson, she's a friend of the family, 4-year-old Samario Dotson, who is his nephew, Cecil's son, and 2-year-old Cecil Dotson II, who is Cecil's son and also Jesse's nephew. And so he's just admitted that he did it, and he even told his mother. We are going to kind of push to the trial and discuss that.
Yeah, we've got a lot to talk about. Also, we'll do our disclaimer that we're going to be going over some of the children's testimony, which can be quite disturbing. So we're going to start off with Kiara Jones, and she's the daughter of Junior's girlfriend. And she testified that at 10 or 10:30 p.m. on March 1st, 2008, Junior and Cecil came to her home and that they both appeared to be intoxicated. When she told them her mother wasn't home, Cecil wanted to leave, but Junior only wanted to leave after he was allowed to come in and make sure she wasn't there. Kiara testified that Junior returned between 3 and 4:30 a.m. and she allowed him to enter the apartment, but she went back to her bedroom and closed the door. Approximately 5 minutes later, he knocked on her bedroom door and asked to talk to her. And she was putting her son to sleep, and she told Junior that she would speak with him shortly, but she fell asleep. She never talked to him.
Okay.
So before falling asleep, she said she heard running water in the bathroom. Kiara was asleep when her mother came home, and Junior and her mother left together the next morning.
Not to sound silly, but it's already like 4:30 in the morning. You think they just left a couple hours later, probably?
Yeah, it's weird. I don't know when anybody's sleeping.
I know.
Everybody's up all the time.
They are. It's true. It's hard to keep track of the time.
Yeah. After they had left, Kiara said she noticed some bleach spots on the brown rug in the bathroom. And she also noticed that a bottle of Clorox bleach was left in the hallway, and it wasn't in its usual place. She also denied arguing with Junior about being home alone with her boyfriend. I think you'd mentioned that in the beginning.
Right. So he had originally told police that they got in an argument because her boyfriend was over there when he got there. It's not your business, mm-hmm. but I mean, he's dating the mom, so he's just trying to make sure she's doing right, I guess.
So next on the stand was Cecil's former girlfriend, Erica Smith, and she told the jurors that Cecil and Jesse were both drunk and arguing on the evening of March 1st, 2008, and that the dispute was apparently still in progress when she made a series of phone calls to Cecil's phone hours later. So they were still arguing. Okay, this is a quote from the ex-girlfriend during the trial. I called Cecil at 2 o'clock in the morning on March 2nd, and he was arguing with Jesse. There was loud arguing in the background. He brushed me off and said, I'll call you back. I tried again around 30 minutes later, but couldn't get him. And her 2-year-old son was with Cecil, and he was one of the murder victims.
Cecil too.
Yes. So the phone records showed that the calls were actually made around 1 a.m., and 1:37 a.m. that morning. But that's pretty close to when she said.
Yeah.
And it's hard to remember exact times when you aren't really thinking about it, mm-hmm. being important later.
Exactly.
So the defense attorney asked, where in the police statement did it say you heard arguing over the phone? And she said it wasn't in the statement because she didn't think it was important at the time. But it makes a lot of sense now. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, and if they argue a lot, so it seems like they had a rocky relationship. And, you know, everybody knows those two people that have, like, spats all the time.
Yeah,
and maybe it's just normal. And it just wasn't a thing for them to worry about.
So then they bring Nicole to the stand, and that's Cecil and Junior's sister. Nicole stated that she never asked Junior to move in with her, and she didn't even really want him living there, but she was afraid to ask him to leave. And she also told the courtroom that Junior had a grudge against the whole family because they didn't visit him while he was in prison.
Now, his mom did, but she only visited once.
Yeah. And how long was he in there the first time? Like 14 years?
He got out after like 13.
13.
13 to 14, you're right. Yeah.
That's a long time.
Mm-hmm. Especially with no visitation, yeah. Like nobody visits you.
But she also ended up mentioning that he had been in prison before for murder. And up until this point, the jury was aware that he had served time in the past, but they didn't know what he had been to prison for.
Ooh, that's, yeah.
I don't know that they were supposed to, that she was supposed to mention it. You know, I mean,
they can't tell him not to say something, yeah. But I mean, maybe they can. Maybe they can say, we don't talk about that or something, or the lawyers themselves maybe can't.
So she said, this is Nicole. She said the night the killings were discovered, many of the family members, including Junior, had gathered outside the house on Lester Street. Junior was telling her not to talk to the media or the police or anyone because they would try to blame him because of his criminal background. He even made the comment that the gangster disciples probably did it.
Hmm.
So he's already worried about it, which, I mean, that's understandable too, I guess.
He's been in prison for murder before.
It's not looking good.
Exactly. See why he would be panicked.
Yeah. He's concerned. So Jesse Sr., the dad, testified that when he learned of the killings, he believed they were gang related because Cecil had told him that he was attempting to leave the gangster disciples and was worried that they might harm him. Cecil had asked Jesse Sr. to move in with him, explaining that gang members respect the family of other gang members and would be unlikely to harm Cecil if Jesse Sr. was living with him. And now, his dad did move in with him. He only lived there for about a month because several of his brothers were warning him that he would likely be killed if he interfered with Cecil's situation with the other gang members.
Oh.
So he got nervous, I guess, and...
And left.
And left and moved out.
Oh my goodness.
Jesse Sr. recalled seeing a gun on the counter at Cecil's home the evening the group gathered to watch the basketball game. And he later learned that this gun belonged to Junior. Jesse Sr. described the gun as a kind of like a powder blue, stated that it was a revolver with the kind of thing that turns, that's what he said, and that it wasn't the type of gun that ejected shell casings, which is important.
Right.
If they're finding them all over, you know, a revolver.
Doesn't.
It stays in the gun until you remove them.
Yeah.
Jesse Sr. recalled seeing Cecil move the gun out of reach, commenting that the children might mistake it for a toy because of the blue color, and that Cecil even told Junior where he put his gun. So it was Junior's gun.
Okay.
All right. So next is Mr. Waddell. We were calling him Fat in the last episode. That's what he goes by.
Mm-hmm.
So he testified that on March 1st, 2008, him and Cecil visited Doc Holliday during the day because Doc wanted Cecil to perform some maintenance work for him. According to Fat, Junior and Cecil were not arguing during the time he spent with them. He did remember seeing Junior with a black and silver gun that evening instead of the blue revolver that he ordinarily carried.
Hmm.
So he had a different gun.
It seems like that gun would stand out, like, and you would notice if somebody didn't have it.
Mm-hmm. But two of the surviving children also had an opportunity to testify. The oldest surviving victim was in the fifth grade by the time of the trial. CJ testified that he'd shared a single bedroom with his brothers. He slept on the top bunk, and his brothers, Cedric and Samario, slept on the bottom bunk. His older sister, who was not home at the time of the attack, used the other bedroom, and his parents' bedroom was located in the back of the house. And CJ recalled on the night of the attacks, he was watching television in his sister's room because the television in his room was not working. Hearing a gunshot, CJ says he walked out and saw Junior pointing a gun at Cecil, not saying a word. He then states that he saw some smoke and sparks come from the gun and then looked down on the ground and saw another dude on the floor who was wearing a black shirt and black pants. And then CJ testified that when he heard the gunshot, he peeked through the door, walked into the hallway, and saw Junior shooting at a woman who was on the arm of the couch. And CJ says he didn't recognize the woman, but he remembered that she was telling Junior that she loved him, but Junior kept shooting. CJ goes back to his sister's room, and once he's in there, he hears footsteps coming down the hall. And so you had brought up, like, his testimony is a little bit off.
Right, and he does. He had a head injury, and when you're a child, you don't remember things exactly in order. Because I questioned that he heard a gunshot, he went into the hallway, and he saw what happened to his dad. But then he also testifies that he heard another gunshot, and he peeked through the door. And so he went back to the room, and then he hears that other gunshot, and he peeks through the door. It just wasn't clear, even when we were looking the stuff up. And so I just questioned if it was what happened first. But he was a child, and he had a severe head injury.
So he claims that, CJ claims that Junior comes into the room holding a folding pocket knife that he used to cut CJ on the neck with. CJ then tells Junior, "I love you," with Junior replying, "No, you don't." And CJ lays back on the bed and hears Cecil 2 begin to cry, and Junior telling Cecil 2, "Don't worry about it. You ain't gonna get hurt."
Oh my gosh. Like, I can't imagine.
So after this, I guess maybe he left the room after he stabbed CJ, because CJ said he was going to get the phone to call the police and he saw Junior's feet in the doorway.
Okay.
So I don't know if he left and came back.
So he's in the bedroom.
Right.
During this attack.
Right.
Okay.
And Junior asked him what he was doing, and CJ told him he was going to get the phone to call the police. Junior said, "If you do that, I'll kill your parents and their friends." And so CJ then asks if he can go and use the bathroom, and noticed that Junior had a kitchen knife in his hand. So Junior did allow him to go and use the bathroom, but he stated that Junior made him put his head in the tub. Doing as he was told, he put his head in the tub, and then Junior tried to stab him in the chest. CJ put his hands up to block the blows, and that's when the knife went into his head.
Oh my gosh.
CJ remembers seeing his mother, Marissa, in the doorway of the bathroom, saying she didn't want to die. This is when Junior asked for Cecil's cell phone and car keys. Marissa told him that the keys are more than likely in Cecil's car. Then CJ hears Junior tell Marissa, "Sorry, because I ain't let your husband and your husband's friends get away with it, and the kids."
But that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I don't know what he's referring to.
Right.
And then CJ said he heard a huge fall on the ground. That's what he described it as. Okay, so it's after this that CJ sees Junior in the hallway going into his older sister's room with a garbage bag and another kitchen knife.
I guess I need to understand the layout of the house, and I didn't look that up because, like, he's in the bathroom.
It sounds like he's just going back and forth, back and forth.
But he's not, though. I think he's pretty much in the bathroom the whole time. But I wonder, like, is it...
Well, CJ's in the bathroom right now.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's the... bedroom, like, is it across the hall, or is it diagonal to where he's able to see everything? Because he's in the tub with a knife sticking out of his head. Because there's a lot of activity that he's seeing and remembering.
Yeah. He then hears someone yelling and Junior saying, "Shut up." It's after that that he hears Samario ask to use the bathroom. And when Samario gets in the bathroom, CJ sees blood dripping from Samario's head onto the rim of the toilet seat. So he's been hurt as well. He states that Samario asked Junior if he can go back to his room, and Junior says that he can.
I don't understand. Yeah, like, I'm not saying because of the kid's testimony. I'm just, like, the whole situation.
Yeah, he's, like, stabbing him and then saying, "Yeah, you can use the restroom." It doesn't make it's weird.
It is. And it's probably, it may just, I don't.
So next, CJ said Junior went into the kitchen, grabs another knife, and then enters the bedroom that CJ shares with his brother. CJ then sees Samario lying on the bed and Junior stabbing Samario, and he ends up falling onto the floor. And CJ says that he hears rambling in the hallway near the laundry room as if Junior was attempting to move something out of the way. CJ then ends up falling asleep in the bathtub and doesn't hear anything else for the rest of that night. I'm sure he passed out.
Yeah, bless his heart.
The next time he remembers is waking up and seeing firemen in his bedroom looking at Samario. He remembers one of the firemen coming into the bathroom and getting him out of the tub. And then he remembers being transported to the hospital by ambulance. And CJ said that no one was with Junior during the attacks and that he acted alone. Once the trial started, more than 2 years had passed since CJ identified Junior as the lone perpetrator of the crimes. During that time, CJ had not wavered from his identification of the perpetrator. So he'd been saying the whole time, it was Junior. However, CJ also testified that he had told Miss Pat in a previous interview that the same night that the bad things happened, a woman named Cassandra knocked on the door and said that she needed to use the bathroom. I think Miss Pat is like a social worker or something.
Yeah, or she's one of the police officers, like one of the detectives that came and talked to him.
Okay. She and some other people, including a man wearing a mask with a little bit of blood on it, entered the house. CJ had never seen the man before, but he recalled Cecil referring to the man as Roderick. CJ couldn't remember who allowed Roderick to enter the house, although he acknowledged that he had previously told Mrs. Pat that Cecil allowed Roderick to enter and that he was mad at Cecil for doing so. CJ testified that Roderick said something to Cecil about the gang and also told Cecil, "You got too big, boy," according to CJ. Roderick fired a gun at Cecil and said, "Never stop playing with the gang, boy. You never know what would happen, boy."
Well, that holds up with a potential gang-related murder.
Yeah, so he's kind of mixed up with his stories here. But he was very young.
I mean, it could have happened.
It could have happened.
Yeah, but then they could, I mean, it sounds like they went over threatening, scaring him like, that you're not leaving unless we say you can leave. It's kind of what it sounds like.
So you think this could have happened before Junior attacked everybody?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the thing is, it's like CJ was 9 and he suffered severe injuries. He was, oh my gosh. You know, just your time frame, even like has to be slightly distorted of the certain things that you remember. But I don't know. I'm not a brain doctor.
Well, CJ also testified that he saw a fight in the living room between Cecil and the man in the mask, and again maintained that the man was shooting at Cecil. He also agreed that he had met with Miss Caroline and Miss Pat at Miss Pat's office, and he said that when they asked him how he knew some of these things, he told them that his granny had told him. So he may have been hearing people talk about stuff and then forming a false memory.
Right.
It's possible.
Or maybe it might not have happened that day. Maybe it happened on a different day and he's just remembering hearing about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, this did happen like 2 weeks ago, or it happened the day before this happened. You know, the murders happened. Because a lot of times kids don't understand like the concept of time in the sense of like adults. We're like, when did that happen? They just know that it happened. And maybe it was running together.
So there was also testimony from Cedric, who was 5 years old at the time. And the stuff that he says in the court doesn't really make any sense. I read it and read it. And
he was 5.
Yeah, I mean, he was little and it didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Cedric said that Junior had stabbed him on the nose, forehead, and wrist, and that no one else was with him. He also stated that Junior got a knife from his car and stabbed everybody, but doesn't remember hearing any gunshots that night. Cedric also stated that after he was stabbed, him and CJ got on their bikes and rode to the grandmother's house.
Oh.
He also confirmed that he had also listened to family members discuss the attacks from that night as well. So he probably he doesn't really remember.
Right. Right. And he was 5. That's traumatic.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe in his little mind at that time, yeah. They rode to grandma's because his brain was trying to protect it, maybe.
Yeah. But that did not happen. I mean, they were found at the house.
Exactly.
Yeah. Special Agent Lawrence James, a forensic scientist from the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, testified as an expert in forensic serology and DNA analysis. He analyzed numerous blood samples taken from the house and determined that each of them matched to one of the victims, but none of them matched to Junior. A partial DNA profile he obtained from a bullet fragment recovered from the sofa in the living room was consistent with a male, and Cecil could not be excluded as a contributor. He swabbed all of the green beads recovered at the scene, but the sample produced only a partial profile, consistent with male DNA that did not match any of the victims or Junior.
And so the green beads were actually their hair beads that were in one of the children's hair. And they were apparently everywhere after the attack.
Special Agent James testified on cross-examination that his analysis on Junior's pants, which were seized following his arrest, revealed only blood matching Junior's. He found no blood of any of the victims on Junior's clothing. He also did not find Junior's DNA on the knife blades, the knife handles, the victims' bodies, the wooden boards, the glass, the pillows, the shotgun, or the shell casings, or the shoes. So there's none of his DNA.
I just don't understand how someone could do those things and literally there'd be no DNA.
Yeah, it seems like with the boards especially, it was just a fit of rage.
Yeah, and you wouldn't, I mean, you would have to literally just burn the boards, get rid of them, because that's a very porous material.
Seems like there'd be some evidence
of a splinter, something. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he didn't have any victim's blood on him. It was just his. Like, was it a lot? Or, like, was it just he cut himself and it was old? I don't understand of that at all.
He also testified that the analysis of scrapings from Miss Robertson's nails yielded a DNA profile of an unknown female.
Oh.
And there was a little bit of mention of the hairs you talked about that were on the body.
On Shindry's, yeah.
And those had came back as Cecil's.
Mm-hmm.
And then an unidentified woman, I believe.
Okay.
Also.
Well, Cecil would make sense because it's his house.
Yeah, it was probably just from the house, you know.
Yeah. And I think that's why they weren't really concerned about them.
Yeah. Dr. Nancy Aldridge, a psychotherapist and expert in the forensic evaluation of children, explained the protocol for conducting forensic interviews of a child and expressed her concerns about the manner in which CJ and Cedric's interviews were conducted. Her concerns included the fact that CJ was interviewed shortly after being discovered. He was interviewed on 4 or 5 different occasions and ended up giving different statements on what had occurred. She also expressed concern that the formal forensic interviews of the children did not occur until August 13, 2008, more than 5 months after the incident, explaining that given the time that had passed, the children possibly had been exposed to information other family members had about the crime, which is what we kind of discussed already. They were talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Aldridge testified that CJ's initial account of the incident in which he named Cassandra was possibly reliable because persons observing the interview described CJ as appearing to relive the trauma as he gave the statement. Dr. Aldridge also noted that the initial interviewers had appropriately used open-ended questions, so they did that right.
That's good. That's what I was wondering.
She explained that generally initial interviews of children produce more accurate information concerning a traumatic event because a child's memory becomes less clear with the passage of time and with repetitive interviews. Their memories of the events may also become contaminated by information learned from others. Dr. Aldridge also explains that if a child is questioned after having already provided an answer, the child may conclude that the initial answer was unacceptable and provide a different answer.
Yes. And a lot of children will do that. We have kids. If they feel like that's not what you want to hear, if they're eager to please, they'll give you a different. They'll say something until they get, oh, that's what I was supposed to say.
Mm-hmm. And so his story had changed several times, apparently.
Mm-hmm. But I'm going to agree with the fact that there was people talking around him, and that can skew your memory,
mm-hmm.
especially a child.
Dr. Aldridge also emphasized the particular importance of recording from the beginning all statements of a child who had been severely traumatized. Recordings preserves a record of the sequence in the child's memory and how each memory resurfaced. Dr. Aldridge testified that although some of the records she reviewed in this case referenced interviews of CJ, no transcripts or recordings of those interviews were available, so she was not able to determine who had spoke to CJ, what questions had been asked, or what information CJ had given prior to the interviews that were actually recorded.
And so, let's just make the statement now. Guess. 48 hours was there, but the judge would not allow those recordings into the courtroom. They could not be used as evidence because of the fact that the police department did not own those recordings. Therefore, he was not sure what was actually edited, and so he would not allow that in as evidence. So that includes Junior's confession.
Which messes up the whole investigation.
It does, and I don't understand. I guess I don't understand the contract portion of it because does that mean that any and all recordings belong to the company? No. Because they, did they not have their own recordings? Like the police?
It doesn't sound like it.
I'm so confused by that. And it's so frustrating to me. Case closed. But she couldn't even hear all of the recording. None of them. So she doesn't actually get to listen to an interview, a formal one, until in August, but the initial ones when he was saying that it was Junior.
Yeah.
I'm upset about that. 48 Hours no longer has those. They don't have the originals. They only have their edited ones that they did for the show.
Which the show, I mean, that's it theirs. Makes him look guilty.
Yeah.
And he probably did do it.
Listen, we don't
know. It's just, it is a bit, there's some things that are odd about the whole scenario.
Yeah.
Dr. Aldred's also expressed concerns about CJ and Cedric's trial testimony, stating the concern that I had for these children is they seemed to be very, very clear as to what questions were going to be asked each one of them and what their answers were. So they were very prepared for the testimony. Although the reliability of CJ's testimony was an issue for the jury, she questioned its reliability because CJ seemed to agree with whatever question was asked of him. So he's trying to give good answers.
But here's the thing, is when you are going to trial, your lawyers, they do coach you. Like, that's probably not the right thing. I mean, they're not coaching you to lie, but they coach you so that when you get up there, you know what to expect. And you know how hard maybe the prosecutor or the defense attorney is going to push. So they ask you questions that they feel like they're going to ask so that you can answer the question. So they can maybe see how you're going to react. So it's not uncommon, but I think what it is it sounds scripted maybe. Yeah. It sounds like they knew exactly what was going to be asked to them and they were going to give this answer no matter what.
She also noted that given the 2.5 year period that had elapsed between the crime and the trial, there was a potential for contamination of the children's memories, which is what we've said several times already.
Yeah. And even for an adult. I mean, even an adult.
It's hard to remember stuff, even traumatic things.
Well, yeah.
In order and stuff, you know. All right. So Junior was the final witness at his trial. And this was weird to me. Normally, you don't testify at your own trial.
They usually don't let you.
I mean, you can. It's your decision. It sounds like he wanted to get up there and tell his story.
And that makes sense. I get it.
He was probably told not to.
Depending on if lawyers are trained very well to push your buttons, to get you to a high state of, they want you to become overly stimulated, overly stressed, because then you're going to slip up.
You'll lose your composure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you show yourself, if you're the one being perceived as the bad guy, they want you to look like the bad guy if they're the prosecutor.
Well, so he gets up there to testify. He testified that he went with Hollis and Cecil to see Frank at his apartment so that Hollis could retrieve his gun. When they arrived at Frank's apartment complex, Junior stayed in the car, but Hollis and Cecil exited the vehicle. As they walked towards Frank's apartment, a man walked down the steps and talked to Hollis and Cecil about the incident that had occurred on February 14th when Cecil told the police about the marijuana in Frank's girlfriend's apartment. Hollis eventually proceeded to Frank's apartment alone, but Cecil remained in the parking lot arguing with the man who had walked down the steps. Junior said Cecil often argued with others. I guess he's very confrontational. Junior said that the man was attempting to calm Cecil, but Cecil and Frank were into it. That's what he claimed.
Okay.
Because Cecil and Frank were into it, and Cecil believed that the man should be on his side.
Because it was Frank's girlfriend that called the police initially anyways.
Right.
But it was Cecil that was getting rode up.
By the gang.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's upset, saying, you should be on my side. I didn't even call the police here. Hollis was aware of Cecil's argument with Frank, and that was why Hollis had gone alone into the apartment to retrieve his gun. Junior testified that when the man attempted to hug Cecil, Cecil asked why, pulled up his shirt, and told the man that he didn't have nothing on him. So he was just showing that he didn't have a gun.
Oh, is that why he would have hugged him?
I guess he was hugging him to see if he's got a gun, probably.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
He's just trying to nonchalantly check, see if he had a gun, probably.
Okay. I didn't realize that that's what would happen. Like, oh, that's how it was done. I don't know. Okay.
Cecil told the man that he wanted to fight Frank and instructed the man to go get Frank. So he's telling him, go get him. I'm going to fight him. When the man instead, he got into his black car, his black Impala, Cecil yelled, y'all know where I stay at, before returning to his own car.
That just sounds like a bunch of shit talking. Like, they all know each other.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it. It's a dangerous situation if you're in a gang and they're pissed at you, but they probably talk to each other like at all time. So that may or may not be a serious conversation. I'm just trying to say, like, it may not, like, you know.
Yeah.
When we're play fighting our oldest child thought that we were having a domestic.
Is there a domestic?
Yeah, that's domestic. Literally what he said. Is there a domestic? And we were just joking around with each other, like...
calling Officer Sharkley. Junior said that he and Cecil laughed about that and told Cecil that Frank tried to call him. When Frank called again, Cecil answered. However, the caller was actually Hollis, who was asking where they were. Cecil told Hollis they were waiting on him, and Cecil also told Junior that he had just punked the man who tried to hug him. Junior told Cecil to go inside and get Hollis, but Cecil refused, so Junior went to get him from Frank's apartment. It sounds like he didn't want to go up there.
Yeah.
Even though he was calling him out.
Because, well, Hollis knows that they're waiting on him, right?
Yeah.
So why is he calling?
Yeah, that's what I thought. It's kind of weird. Like, almost like he wanted him to come in there.
Unless that's all a lie.
So Junior says when he got in there, he saw Frank and a man who he didn't know inside the apartment. Junior told Hollis that him and Cecil were ready to leave. And so then him and Hollis left Frank's house. But then they all go to Sheila Jones's home.
That's Junior's girlfriend.
Yeah, Junior and Cecil went inside looking for Sheila, but she was not home. And Junior stated that he caught Kiara's boyfriend in one of the bathrooms with his pants halfway down. And then Kiara began cursing him and they left. So she's yelling at him. So then they head over to Marilyn's home, who is the maternal grandmother of Junior's son.
Okay.
Where they stayed for less than 5 minutes because Junior's son wasn't there. From there, they go and pick up Shendry Robertson, Hollis Seal's girlfriend. Okay. And then they go to pick up $45 worth of marijuana.
Okay.
They drove to another woman's home and stayed for 30 or 40 minutes before returning to Cecil's house. According to Junior, that him, Cecil, Hollis, Marissa, and Shendry were together in the living room with Marissa drinking a wine cooler and Shendry preparing a marijuana cigarette.
Is that literally how he said it? A marijuana cigarette? That sounds like a 1950s FBI agent.
We're in the court. We got to be proper.
Okay.
She's rolling a blunt.
Okay.
Cecil asks Marissa to go put clean sheets on the bed in the master bedroom. Because Hollis and Shendry were going to spend the night. I guess Hollis had just been released from jail also. Junior said that he volunteered to change the sheets and that he was in the master bedroom with a quilt in his hand when he heard two or three gunshots.
Can I just say that I find it strange that he offered to change the sheets? He doesn't live there.
Apparently.
Let's say you're at Matt and Kelly's house and they got two friends that are going to stay the night, that they're letting spend the night. That'd be like you going, I'll change the sheets because Kelly doesn't want to.
I don't make my own bed.
Exactly. I just find that odd that he was like, I'll do it.
Yeah, it sounds like bullshit.
It does. It does. Or he's like, let me get out of the way before people start shooting.
Oh.
I don't know. I'm just saying stuff. Like, I'm not accusing. I'm just saying.
Junior acknowledged that he was carrying a blue .44 caliber handgun at the time. But when he heard the screaming, he hid beneath the bed. I don't know that they ever found that gun, the revolver.
Well, where's the AK-47 that was apparently in the house?
Yeah, I wondered that too. There's no mention of it anywhere, if they actually found one.
Okay.
But the fact that it's a .44 caliber and none of the other casings...
were a .44?
It's interesting. So I guess didn't use that one. Whoever didn't use that one, clearly.
But he was seen with a different gun.
That's true. Yeah, earlier. The black. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he hid under the bed. When he came out and saw the carnage, he grabbed a bike from behind the door and rode to his girlfriend's house. Once he got to the girlfriend's house, he says he threw up, and that's why there were bleach stains on the carpet. He used the bleach to clean up the puke. And his reason for not going to police, this is a quote from him. If I call the police, I'd be just like my brother. I'd be dead like him.
I seriously doubt that he was hiding under the bed while all of that was happening. That makes no sense. Like, how in good conscience could you stay under the bed?
If you have a gun already.
And all those people are being attacked and murdered, especially children. Even the hardest man, when a child is being hurt, like, will not stand for it.
It's not a very good story.
It's really not. This is where I was like, pfft. Okay.
Yeah, it's flimsy.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what we'll call it.
So Junior stated that the police coerced him into a confession by using scare tactics for 6 hours. Junior said he confessed to police because they threatened to let the other murderers have at him. He said that they told him that I'll throw you on the fourth floor and let them kill your ass. So yeah, I confessed.
Let's just state as well, he had asked because that original confession, nobody has the entire thing. They don't have the whole 6 hours. Nobody else was able to listen to the whole 6 hours. He asked to listen to all of CJ's discussion and they wouldn't have let him. And I get that because he's the one that's, you know, they're looking at. However, it seems like his attorney would have been able to listen to that. But if they're not allowing it.
I would say that, I mean, we're not defending him at all. We're just pointing out the odd parts of the story.
Yeah, I don't understand.
There's a lot of things that are very strange.
This isn't even all the stuff. It would take us days to get through this.
It's a lot. Yeah, it's a whole lot.
There's no DNA. He has no wounds. His clothing only had his blood on it. They didn't take any pictures of his hands, remember?
Yeah, they or his clothes. Well, they took his pants.
Uh-huh.
No pictures of his hands to see if there's any wounds or if they're fighting anybody off.
Shoes? Like, with everything that was going on, that's something. Like, your shoes are going to pick up all kinds of stuff. Like, where's the shoes?
Because they didn't suspect him at first. They thought it was gang related.
But then you bag a tag at mass and move on, you know?
Right. He was there. Need all that stuff.
And it was fairly quickly. So if he had gotten hurt in any way, like with his hands, like with the knives and stuff, even breaking them off, like I guess that's where I'm like, I don't understand. Even with gloves on, you can cut yourself. I don't understand how there's no DNA when he was there casually.
Honestly, I feel like if he had not confessed, he probably would have gotten out of trouble because there's only the testimony of the children. And I mean, even those are back and forth and they're not very good.
And we're not discounting anything that they say.
No.
Yeah, we're not.
It just was, they were little and it was a long time between trial and stuff.
Yeah, but I don't know. This is so frustrating. They never found the guns. There's a lot of missing items, I guess. And some things police don't release, but it's gone to trial and stuff, so.
Right, but the fact of someone showing up and killing people with items already in the apartment is strange. It seems like he very much did do it.
It didn't make sense for all the adults to be shot, drugs planted on them. Also, let's make sure everybody knows, when they did, this wasn't a drug-related thing. Only one person had marijuana in their system, and everybody else had ethanol in their system, but the coroner couldn't rule out that they had been drinking because it was the amount that was in there was an amount that is naturally produced after someone passes. I just want to say that because of the drugs that were found. This was definitely not a drug-related. It was planted, obviously. I feel like if anything, that somebody would have grabbed the drugs. They wouldn't have left them there. Because I thought that was just weird.
It seems kind of set up, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then all the stuff of moving people around, I don't know. It does not, I don't know. Ugh, it's just, and then the kids, it was so different. It's almost like you had two different people in the house. You had this person that was shooting people and this person who was personal, beating and stabbing people. That's a very personal attack. It seems like you would want to be a little more personal with the adults.
The jury deliberated for less than 2 hours. Junior was found guilty on first-degree murder in the shooting deaths of his brother Cecil, Cecil's girlfriend Marissa Williams, Hollis Seals, Shendry Robertson, and his nephew Cecil II, and Samario. He received 120 years and 6 death sentences. He was set to be executed on March 2, 2012, and then again on November 17, 2015. Jesse Jr. Dotson is still on death row at the Riverbend Maximum Security Institution in Nashville, Tennessee.
His original execution was the date that all of them got killed. It was 4 years to the day. I would be interested to know what other people think about it. Like if they were to look at our resources, because yet we didn't discuss all of the evidence. There's so much. And there were even some disturbing things found, like during like the trial blog.
The only thing that definitively points at Junior is the testimony from the children.
Yeah. And then his confession.
And his confession, obviously.
Oh, and he didn't sign a report. He didn't sign a confession. That was another thing, is his defense attorney was able to say he didn't actually sign a confession. Because they usually sign that they did it. You know, this is my statement, and they sign he didn't do it.
It's a weird case.
So I say, watch that 48 hours, read some of these articles, and then I need somebody to tell me what am I missing. After he said he hid under the bed, I said, bullshit. Thanks for visiting us this week.
We'll be back next week.
Yeah. Don't forget to like us, love us, rate us, share us, review us, listen to us again on all your special platforms.
Send us an email.
eerieandabsurd@gmail.com.
If you got something you want to talk about, any suggestions, some creepy topics.
Whatever you want. Until next time.
Don't hide under the bed. Shoot back.
Fuck off, yeah. Fucker.
Wow, you're so inappropriate.
No. Okay, bye.
Until next time, fellow Absurdians, remember, everything you've heard is true. Monsters are real, and the strangers in black are not a figment of your imagination. Don't forget to subscribe and rate us on iTunes or your favorite podcast streaming service. Do you have a story you want to share? Contact us at eerieandabsurd@gmail.com or visit our website at eerieandabsurd.com to submit a suggestion. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram, both at eerie_absurd.